certainly thankful for this opportunity to be back with you again. Certainly enjoyed our times we've been able to be with you in the past. Appreciate your request to have you in prayer, because we're very much mindful of the fact that we must have the blessing and presence of the Lord to be able to effectively speak in His name. I want to read from the 102nd Psalm, beginning with the 24th verse. I said, O my God, take me not away in the midst of my days. Thy years are throughout all generations. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years shall have no end. The word change is found in that 26th verse by saying, the heavens that the Lord has made, the earth that He has created, shall perish, wax old like a garment. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. There's evidence of change all about us. The fact that this particular evening is singled out around the world to recognize a change in the calendar is an indication that change attracts a lot of attention. There'll be thousands of people gathered in Times Square, in other large cities of the world tonight, just to recognize a change from one year to the next. Some people will probably celebrate in a fashion that would be totally unacceptable for the conduct appropriate to a child of God. Others hopefully will have their minds turned, as I trust we shall hear this evening, to the mercies of the Lord, both to give thanks for those which are past and to pray for those that are needed in the new year. But this text speaks of some things that shall change, and speaks of one who shall never change. And we want to address both of those points and also consider some things that ought to change. As we look over our life of the past year, we can recognize that life is full of changes. Some changes are very pleasant changes. There may be some in this audience tonight who got married this last year. That's made a big change in your life, and that was a happy event. Some of you that may had a child born or a grandchild born, and that was a happy event. Others of you have had great sadness, as you have lost loved ones and you've gone to the bedside of those who were sick. and you've tried to comfort those who are in deep sorrow. But those changes, whether joyous changes or changes that break our heart, are all a part of life. And we ourselves change. Our thoughts change, our attitudes change, our emotions change. Some days, without really being able to tell why, we feel cast down, don't have the same energy and excitement about life that we do at other times. In days of youth, generally we feel that whatever opinions we have about life in general at that moment are absolute. We're going to hold them for the rest of our life. We're just not going to change. I had a very good friend many years ago that we would enter into discussion about a lot of things, and many of them were scriptural topics. And this friend said, as life goes on, you're going to find out you'll change many times about some of these things we're discussing. And at that point, I was so dogmatic on every little intricate detail, I said, no, you're wrong. I'm sure I'm just not going to change. And that has come back ringing in my ears many times as I've gone through some of the various changes that occur as we travel along life's journey. I'm not suggesting to you that we ought to constantly be changing on everything that we believe, because the purpose of the gifts in the church is that the Lord's people might not be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. But you can rest assured that if you're growing at all, you're going to change about some things. You're going to have deeper insight, better understanding. You're going to have to correct some of the erroneous thoughts that you've had. So there will be change. And here, the psalmist has described some of his changes, some of his doleful feelings that are laid out in rather vivid detail in the first part of this psalm. He begins by saying, hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from me in the day when I'm in trouble. Incline thine ear unto me in the day when I call, answer me speedily. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. Have you ever been in such darkness, such trouble of mind, such perplexity, that you could have described your condition as David described his? My days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth, and my heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. Even in these expressions, there is that reference to the brevity of life. In the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah, it speaks of our life being as a vapor that appears for a moment and vanishes away, and the grass that grows up in the morning and is cut down, and soon it is gone. Scriptures refer to the passage of time moving more swiftly than the weaver's shuttle. And many, many scriptural expressions bring to our attention the fact that life is fragile. Life is short. We spend our years as a tale that is told. And in the midst of some of the dark times which the psalmist experienced, some which were indeed a direct result of sin in his life, he was brought down to a very low place and said, by reason of the voice of my groaning, my bones cleave to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. Pretty lonely character, wasn't he? I watch and am as a sparrow alone upon the housetop. You ever been in that plight? Where you just felt like, surely there's nobody else like I am. No one else must have the struggles and the conflicts that I experience along the way. I'm unique. My problems are unusual. You just feel to be all alone. David felt that way. A sparrow alone on the housetop. Not a very comfortable place when the cold wintry winds are whipping about him. At a later time, David said, "The sparrow hath found her nest, even thine altars, O Lord." That's a much better place than being on top of the house. To rest upon the altar of the Lord. And I've found some of the Lord's little children that have been around the gospel for a long time, followed after the old Baptist, but never becoming a member of the church, and they remind me of those little sparrows that are out on the top of the house, and they could be so much more comfortable if they would come in and find their nest upon the altar of the Lord. But David goes on to say, "My days are like a shadow that declineth, and I am withered like grass. But thou, O Lord, shalt endure forever, and thy remembrance unto all generations." See, he says, my days are like the shadow that declineth. It's soon going to pass away. I'm like the withered grass. But even when my race is run, when I've come to the end of the journey, O Lord, thou shalt endure forever. He was expecting some changes. He wasn't expecting to be here forever. He was recognizing that we spend our years as a tale that is told. Soon it's over and gone. But Lord, thou shalt endure forever. And then the 22nd verse, "When the people are gathered together in the kingdoms to serve the Lord, he weakened my strength in the way, he shortened my days. I said, O my God, take me not away in the midst of my days. Thy years are throughout all generations." We read of some of the experiences of the old servants of God in times gone by when they were down in such darkness and despair that they despaired even of life. But at this moment, David is praying, "Lord, take me not away in the midst of my days. Bless me to go on in spite of these struggles and conflicts that I'm encountering." And then he says, "Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands." It is not difficult for those to whom God has given faith to believe that he, the Lord, is the creator of heaven and earth. While the Genesis account of creation seems to be rather strange and unbelievable to many, it just makes good sense to those who are made to believe that God is the sovereign ruler of the skies, and that it was no difficult undertaking for him to create the heaven and the earth in 6 days as we know them. In the first chapter of the book of Genesis, 6 times these 4 words are used, "and it was so." God ordered it, God spoke it, and it was so. Wasn't any guesswork, didn't have to wait and see if it was going to happen. He said, "Let it be," and it was so. How good to believe in such a God. A God who is omnipotent, a God who works all things according to the counsel of his own will. Now he says, "Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth." No man assisted him, obviously. God did this by the word of his power. And what a marvelous, amazing creation it is. Aren't you at times overwhelmed with the beauty of God's handiwork? To see the beautiful flowers of springtime, the splendor of the color of the trees in the autumn season, the stars on a clear night filling the sky, the beauty of mountains, the overwhelming expanse of oceans. Just an amazing creation. Nothing to compare with the vivid beauty of a spectacular sunset. And how good when we look at some of these beautiful sights to say, my God did that. This is a evidence of His power. But my Father is the one that holds all of this by the word of His power. Oh, how intricate this creation of God really is. You may have specialized knowledge about some part of it. You may appreciate those beautiful flowers of springtime and know a lot about flowers. A lot about what it takes to make them grow and to care for them and keep the insects off and know about all the different kinds and species of flowers. But I'm sure that even a person who might be very well educated in the field of botany would acknowledge that there are yet many kinds of flowers and many plants in other parts of the earth that you would know very little about. Whatever your field of expertise, you have to recognize that the little bit of knowledge you have about this creation of God is tremendously limited. And the more that man discovers and finds out about what God has made, it helps him to realize how little he knew to start with. Now, we love to see the beauty of His handiwork. We love to stand in amazement at all that He's made, even as He made man Himself. What an amazing part of creation. This human body, with all of the medical research, the doctors are still telling us they're finding out new things. Not that there's anything new about the creation that God wrought, but that man's finding out more about what God did. And they stand amazed at what they discover about this human being that God put here upon the earth. Well, of old thou hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hand. And because God has placed us here on this earth, it's appropriate for us to admire the beauty of His creation, to stand in awe of the very heavens above that He has created, and then as we're here, to recognize that we're not just left here to admire the beauty of what He has made. But as a result of man's fall in the garden, we now have an obligation to be actively involved in caring for this creation. And that if we're going to receive our daily bread, we're going to have to apply ourselves. And so there's some work we're going to have to do. Not all are going to till the soil, but some are going to have to. There's going to be food for us to eat. By the sweat of his brow, man's going to have to make his bread today. And think over this past year about how much of your time, effort, and interest was spent with something that was connected with this creation, this material world in which we now live. How much of your time and effort was spent on your job or getting ready to go to work, or taking care of your flower garden, or trying to get your grass to grow, and then after it started growing, figure out how you were going to work it out in your schedule to cut it, and about how you were going to have to repair what was broken around your house and paint what needed to be painted and replace what was decaying, and on it goes, that an awful lot of time and effort and energy is put forth to attend to these material things, which are all a necessary part of life, at least to some degree they are. But look at the next verse. After he speaks of having laid the foundation of the earth and the heavens that are the work of his hands, he says, they shall perish. Now, reading that language and seeing how that expression follows what he says about the creation itself, to me it certainly casts things in a totally different light than what we sometimes view it. Think about the fact that you were spending so much of your time, interest, and concern over this past year on that which the Scripture says is going to perish anyway. How much time do you suppose you spent this past year worrying? And particularly worrying about things that didn't happen. Probably about 80% of what you worried about didn't happen. But there are some people that really work hard at worrying. They've had a lot of experience in it. They know just how to attack the thing. If they haven't got anything that's currently distressing them, they begin to imagine all the things that could possibly happen, and they just feel like they're under some kind of an obligation to worry a portion of every day. And think about how much of our time we spent getting upset and fretted about things that really didn't matter all that much anyway. I was visiting with the Mazingo family over in Mississippi a few years ago after their house had been destroyed by fire and they had rebuilt at the same site. And Sister Mazingo was talking about how thankful they were that the two boys that were at home were not injured in that fire. And yet there were things that were lost that couldn't be replaced. At a nice home rebuilt at the site, new furniture, but things like pictures of the children, things that had been handed down from previous generations, wasn't any money could put those back. They were gone. And you know, sometimes we think about some of the material things that we treasure so dearly and put such emphasis upon. And yet if we lost all of them, if they all were burned up instantly, our material treasures, whatever they are, antiques, pictures, just treasures that we happen to like for one reason or another, if we're still alive and healthy, we have an awful lot to be thankful for. And when we consider that whatever we have, I don't care how big your house is, how big your farm is, how big your bank account is, even if you own the whole bank, the time's coming, it's going to all burn up. They shall perish. And yet we get so fretted and upset and nervous and overwrought about something that isn't going to last anyway. And of all the people on this earth that ought to know better, God's people ought to know better. We come to church every week and sing about heaven. And yet we go out and think about earth. And then we got a hope of the mercy of the Lord that someday we're going to go and live with Him. And then we go out and live like everything we have and everything that's worth something is right here. What's happening to us now in this present world? Just haven't got our vision focused properly. We've forgotten about some of these things that the psalmist was writing many years ago. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment, and as a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. Now, the Scriptures are always very careful to steer us in the right direction, knowing, as the Lord does certainly, that we in ourselves, the weak, frail creatures that we are, tend to be extremists. It's not human nature to live moderately, to stay on the road. It's human nature to run in the ditch. And if you're not going in one, you'll head for the other. So somebody may say, hey, I like what that preacher's preaching tonight. He's talking about all this stuff going to burn up. I didn't care to be involved with it anyway. I'm going to quit my job Monday morning. I don't like to work. I'm just going to quit and let somebody else feed me. Hey, hold up. Wait a minute. The apostle will take care of your case too, said the man that won't work ought not to eat. Say, we've still got some obligations here. Young person said to me the other day when they were finding out that even young people have to pay taxes, said, well, I didn't understand this situation. Why, this doesn't seem fair that young people ought to have to pay taxes. But you see, even Jesus said that to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. So you've got an obligation to be a tax-paying citizen, a good citizen of your community, of your state, of your country. You have some obligations to fill. You can't just walk out and say, well, I'm just going to think about heaven and long about noontime tomorrow. I hope a box lunch drops down out of the sky and I'll just have everything taken care of. God's not going to feed you that way. You have some things to do while you're here. So, well, wait a minute, preacher, I'm confused. On one hand, you're saying, don't give yourself to all the material and tangible things of this world. On the other hand, you say you can't give it all up. The point is, there are some duties for us to perform, an obligation for us in the service of God here, that which is required even on a daily basis to provide as we work and toil, that which is necessary, but we are not to become so attached to the things of this world that that's where our heart and affection is. You see, we just tend to go totally to the extreme one way or the other. Either just want to give everything up as far as any commitment or obligation, or spend all of our time concentrating on those things so that's all we're thinking about. That's all we're concerned with. And it's really a tough job to try to have the balance. I have people a lot of times come and say, explain that to me. I want you to get that right down to the little intricate mark here where I'll know just where it is. My friends, the Lord has not appointed a pope or potentate in his church. He just uses ministers of the gospel who are earthen vessels to preach the message, and you personally have a responsibility through prayer and the study of his word to make the application and utilize it properly in your life. And there are those who say, well, I was hoping it's going to be easier than that. If you just explain this and work it out for me, I wouldn't mind doing it, but I don't want to have to go through the struggle of trying to pray about this and get this thing in an appropriate form in my own life. But that's what's required. I can't draw up a plan of action for your life. That's something between you and the Lord. I can tell you some things God's word will clearly forbid. I can tell you there's some ungodly things that you ought to avoid and have no part with. But as far as to tell you where you're to live and what kind of a job you're to have and all that God would have your life, there's no way on earth I can know that. I have a tough enough time knowing that for myself, much less go trying to tell somebody else. Oh, that we might get the thing in proper focus. Realizing that there are some things that are changing and shall change, and that everything that we know in this materialistic world, my friends, is already under the death sentence. The fact is coming that these shall wax old like a garment, as a vesture thou shalt change them, and they shall be changed. That one thought ought to give us a whole different attitude and outlook about the matter. Now, if everything a man has, if everything he loves, if everything he hopes for is right here in this world, and he loses it, You can understand why some people become so deeply distressed when the stock market goes down or when some terrible crisis strikes, because it's hit everything they've got. But you see, if your inheritance is incorruptible and undefiled, if it's on the other shore, then it doesn't matter how rough it gets down here, you say, Lord, it's still all right. Thank God there's no crashes over there. There's no thieves breaking through. There's no dishonesty. There's nobody coming to invade the place and take that inheritance away. It's there. It's secure. It's ours by free and sovereign grace. And keeping that before you can give you a calm and quiet spirit in the midst of the greatest storms of life. And then he says, Thou art the same. Thou art the same. I tell you, as many things as are changing and as rapidly as they change in this world today, it's good to know somebody who doesn't change. Because we individually are changing, and everybody we know and are associated with are changing. This country's undergoing dramatic changes as far as the economic makeup, the job structure, and certainly as far as attitudes about moral standards and many other things. There's so many, many changes occurring at a rapid pace today. But he says, in spite of what's changing here on this earth, and in spite of the fact that heaven and earth itself shall someday wax old like a garment and be changed, thou art the same. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. You know, there are some things where you'd kind of like to roll back the clock and say, I really long for some of those simpler, quieter days of youth. Some of you can remember some very precious memories when you were a youngster out on the farm. Even though it was sometimes difficult maybe to get up early in the morning and go out and milk those cows or go out and chop out the field in the heat of the day. Say those are some happy times. We didn't seem to have quite the stress and the pressure and the turmoil that we're experiencing today. How much some of you would give to go back and sit on that big old front porch and hear that squeaky swing again while old granddaddy sat there and told you some of those stories that fascinated you. You'd like to roll back the clock, but you can't. And the farther you go in life, the more rapidly it seems that the time moves. But aren't you glad to know that in spite of the fact that the world has changed dramatically, so much about life today is entirely different than it was just a few years ago. Many ideas and attitudes and opinions have changed. Maybe there are those that you once counted to be dear friends that have disappointed you, and you can't count them as a close friend any longer. And you may still grieve over that. But in spite of all of those changes, he says, Thou art the same. The same God that touched your heart when you were a little child out on the farm. The same God that blessed you in a simpler time in your life is the same God that rules on the throne of the universe today. And the same God that's able to give you the strength to deal with the perplexities and stresses of life today that you must encounter, he's the same. How wonderful to know that. I'm God, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. All you sons of Jacob, you've changed, all right. You've made some changes that were terrible changes. You've gone the wrong way. You've sinned. You've done the wrong thing. But
I'm God, I change not, I'm a covenant-keeping God, I'm a God of mercy and a God of love, and therefore you're not consumed because I'm the same. Salvation in heaven were dependent upon your faithfulness, you making a commitment from which you'd never veered. Where would you stand tonight? But realizing that it depends upon a God who changes not, a God who entered into a covenant before the foundation of the world, a God who promised to save a people, a God who said, I'll be thy God, and they shall be my people. And when he says it, it's as good as done. You can rejoice to say, the Lord's the same. And as we look to 1988, which rapidly approaches, and we say, what will another year bring forth? There may be some here tonight say, I'll be glad when the midnight hour strikes and 1987 is behind me. It's been a rough year for me, and I'll be glad to close the door on it and say it's gone. But none of us know what the new year holds. We can know this. There will be some sorrows. There will be some heartaches. There will be some disappointments. If we could see tonight what we might have to face as individuals in the next year, we might drop to our knees and sob uncontrollably if we thought we'd have to face some of those deep troubles alone. But I'm here to tell you that no matter what the trouble that you might face, no matter what the heartache that you might experience, the Lord is the same, and his grace is sufficient, and he will give us grace when the trial comes.
We get impatient about the thing, and we want the Lord at the beginning of the year to give us a nice new big package of grace, so just we got it on the shelf there, and whenever we need it we can draw from it and apply it to the present hour of need. But my friends, I believe just as God fed his people with manna that came down every morning, he gives us grace for the trials as they occur. As thy days, so shall thy strength be. He supplies it. Thou art the same. But even as we consider these thoughts, as we said in the beginning, we believe that there's another one suggested, although not stated in the text. There are some things that ought to change. Some things that ought to change. There are a lot of things we'd like to see changed in the world. There are things that maybe you'd like to see changed in the lives of people that you love. Maybe some things you'd like to see changed in your church. Hopefully, there are some things that you would like to change in yourself. There are some things that ought to change. And I believe that true gospel preaching is designed with the intent to call for change. We like to receive the comforting message to talk about what God has done. And many times that which is instructive, that which declares a fact, is intended to change our thinking so that we can be informed and think correctly about what is contained in the Word of God. But so many, many times there is a direct call for change in us, in our walk, in our conduct, in what we're doing, and how we respond to the situations that we do face in life. Now, when we think about this new year, which is at hand, what kind of changes would you like to see in this new year? And maybe as you start thinking about the changes you'd like to see in the world, the changes you would like to see in society in general, the changes you'd like to see in this country, you say, but that's unrealistic because things are probably going to get worse instead of better. And what can I do? I'm just one person, and my testimony and influence is so limited, there's really
nothing that I can effectively accomplish, and so I won't give any thought to that. Now, my friends, that's accepting defeat before we ever start. The apostle said, I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. Oh, if we were to constantly hold in view the greatness of this God of whom we speak tonight, the one who has laid the foundation of the earth and the heavens are the work of his hands, if you recognize you're praying to that God, it doesn't matter how big the task, how great the change, you can pray with confidence, Lord, I know thou art able. It matters not how high and mighty the king may be. God's able to humble him and bring him down. It matters not how fierce the enemy may be. God's able to defeat him. Why, you look at how God blessed Israel over and over again in their battles, sometimes defeating a tremendous host of the Midianites, as he did with 300 that were in Gideon's band, and another time caused the enemy to hear a noise so that they fled even when there was no actual danger. See, with the Lord, he doesn't even have to get up an army. He just makes the enemy think there is one, and that's just as good as having it. They didn't even wait to try to look at what they heard. They just fled because of the noise of it. Now, do we believe in a God like that? Then it doesn't matter how impossible it may seem from a human point of view. There's reason to seek and to knock and to ask, because he's promised to give and to open unto us. But when we bring it down from what change we might like to see in the world or in our country or in life in general around us, you bring it into your own personal life. And probably when we start talking about what you would like to see changed in the new year, one of the first things that comes to mind is how you would like for some other people that are involved in your life to do some changing for the better. Parents might say, I sure would like for my children to change. I'd like for them to be more cooperative, more respectful, more obedient, better students. Little folks not make such a mess. When they did make one, pick it up. You know, you could make a lot of, down to pretty intricate details of what changes you'd like to see for the coming year. And some of those may well be in order. There may be some changes that you can implement by prayerfully dealing with those who need to be warned or rebuked from a scriptural standpoint. As a matter of fact, one of the great flaws that troubles the Lord's people in this area is that if they see there is a place where change is in order, a brother's overtaken in a fault and he ought to change, instead of going to him and trying to help change him by the grace of God, they'll talk about him. And all that does is make matters worse. If you see a brother where he is clearly walking in forbidden paths in his attitude, in what he's saying, in what he's doing, in what he's believing, if he's going contrary to the principles of God's Word, you have an obligation to go to that one in the spirit of meekness, trying to restore him, trying to save him in the gospel. And whether it's your child, or your wife, or your husband, or your neighbor, or your deacon, or your pastor, or the person you sit by in church, or whoever it is, you have that obligation. Now let me further caution you that when you accept that responsibility, be sure that it's in the spirit of trying to bring about a positive change on a godly basis, because you are genuinely concerned for that individual and for the glory of the Lord, and that it's not a self-righteous, destructive attack. Matthew chapter 7 warns us in that matter. Verse 1 says, judge not that ye be not judged. What is judging somebody? Some would interpret that to mean the church can never exercise discipline. It obviously is not saying that. But when you look at somebody and say, looks like to me the way that person's dressed or the way he combs his hair or that smirk on his face, I think he must be a proud Pharisee. Now you're judging, because you cannot read a person's heart just by looking at their face. Judge not that ye be not judged, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. You just mark it down. You sit in judgment on somebody else. You judge their motives when you have no basis for it. You judge them when you have no facts and you have no grounds. In due time, you may find yourself needing mercy at the hand of that very person that you judge so severely. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own? Oh, some people are specialists when it comes to looking at other people's eyes. Now open your eye and let me see. And I see that little speck down in there, and you ought to get it out. Oh, why beholdest thou the mote that's in thy brother's eye and considerest not the beam that's in thine own? Isn't it strange how we can become so indignant about the faults and sins of other people and yet justify the ones in our own life? Always find an excuse for them, some justifiable grounds as to why we can't really change ourselves, but all these other people ought to be changing. Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. There's an obligation. If we see there is a need for a change, to prayerfully and scripturally and biblically try to assist in effecting that change, but not to go in an arrogant, bold, self-righteous attitude to nail somebody's hide to the wall. We're going out there with the idea of trying to save somebody, not destroy them. And I believe there's been many a little child of God hurt, and many an old Baptist church has suffered for years as a result of somebody who went in that judgmental, self-righteous spirit rather than in the spirit of love and prayer to try to heal and help. And while there is an area for us to be appropriately concerned about helping others to change, the area where we have the greatest responsibility and probably where we're going to be able to do the most good and effect the greatest change is right with self. Self. Well, you say that's discouraging, because that's the same project I've been on for years. Every year about this time, I look at self. I say, yeah, it's the same old self I've been dragging along here, thinking that next year round maybe it's going to improve. And I draw up my resolutions and I make my promises and I say, I'm going to do better. And sometimes I get clear into the second week of January, look like on a better track, but that's about as far as it goes. What are some things about yourself that should be changed? Well, we suggested in the beginning that when we look back over the past year about how much time we have spent worrying about things that didn't happen, fretting about something that's going to ultimately be burned up anyway, maybe that's a place to start, is with the allocation of our time. Just how has your time been spent this past year? Now, suppose I were to tell you that the way you have used your time this past year had been fed into a computer. We were going to
put a screen up here at the close of the service and invite everybody to come back and be seated in this audience once more and look at this screen as the allocation of your time was flashed up here. We're going to do it in alphabetical order. So your name will come up and you'll be able to see it, and so will everybody else, about how you used your time. And so it's going to show you how many minutes or hours or days or months of your time this past year was spent worrying. How much of it was spent gossiping, talking about people when you shouldn't have. How much of it was spent sowing seeds of discord. How much of it was spent looking at television. And it would be broken down between those programs that you would not have been embarrassed about seeing and the ones you would have been embarrassed if a church member had come in and visited with you while it was on. And how much time you spent reading the newspaper, and how much time you spent reading novels, and how much time you spent going to ball games, and how much time you spent going fishing and going other places on weekends when you couldn't make it to church. And all of this is going to be calculated, and it's going to be flashed on the screen, and of course the percentage will be up there, so you'll know what percent of this time you actually spent reading the Bible as compared to reading the newspaper and reading other books and looking at television and talking about people and pursuing some of these other interests. I wonder how many of us, when we realized that the letter of our name was about to come up, would suddenly want to be excused, and we might be intrigued to come in and look at what everybody else's record was, but we sure wouldn't want to be present when ours was flashed. And yet, isn't it strange how embarrassing it would be for everybody to know just exactly how we allocated our time this past year, and yet God knows that. He doesn't have to use the computer to have it all calculated, but he knows it. He knows all about us. He knows everything we said, everything we did, everything we thought, all the excuses we made about why we didn't do what we should have, claiming we couldn't have when he knows we could have, and we know it. He knows all about us. We have to stand before him. It's not making excuses to the preacher to satisfy him, making excuses to friend, neighbor, somebody else. It's where we stand before him. Oh, that we might redeem the time using that precious commodity that God has given us, because how quickly it's passing. This life is described as being the grass that withering and the shadow that's passing away and the vapor that appears and it's gone. How quickly it's going to be over. Should we not then use the time that we have to the very best of our ability in the service of God, not under a slavish fear of lost service, but out of gratitude and love, to be thankful to the God of heaven for the precious hope that he's given us in his sovereign mercy, to want to seek him first, not second, third, last, but first in all things? Does he not deserve such service? Does he not deserve such honor, seeing who he is and what he is and what he's done for us and how merciful he's been? Oh, how many changes might well be in order in our life for this coming year as far as how we use our time. What a difference it could make in our life if we just spent a little more of our time in this book. Not just letting somebody else read it for us and talk to us about it a couple of times a week, but reading it ourselves. What a difference it makes when somebody would come to me and say, "Why, preacher, that's the very passage of scripture I was reading this last week, and I just feel like the Lord was in the matter because you got up there and preached on it this morning and it was so rich to me." Now, if the person was looking at television last night instead of reading the book, they can't have that experience. That's going to be missed. But what an experience it is when they've been reading it and maybe had a question in their mind, say, "I wish I could understand that." And then a man gets up and explains it. Well, that's just a double blessing. What a difference it is if we're meditating on this precious truth. What a difference it'll give us on a daily basis. A difference in our attitude and our outlook and how we interpret things and where we hit this life of godly moderation, so that we're accepting responsibility for what we ought to be doing, but we're not becoming attached to the material and worldly things about us, that we're neglecting our spiritual service. Where are we going to get that strength and that guidance for the proper decision to be made but in His precious Word? Oh, you say, I'd like to seriously be able to say tonight, as I would go to the Lord in prayer, Lord, by Thy grace, I want to do some changing this next year. But I'm just a hopeless case. I just can't seem to improve. I just can't seem to make those changes. Don't let Satan whip you before you even get started. I don't think there's a person in this house tonight with the love of God in their heart, but what could say, I ought to make some changes in my life, and by God's grace, I'm going to. I know that by the enabling power of His Holy Spirit, I can do it. I know I'm weak in the flesh. I know left to myself, I'll stumble and fall, but by God's grace, there's some changes I can make. Maybe there's some unfinished business you need to attend to. Maybe you've been carrying a grudge for 6 months. Maybe you carried it through the whole year. Maybe some of you have been carrying it for 5 years or 10 years. It's time to unload that baggage that's weighing you down. It's displeasing to God to start with. Be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven us. You say, but it's so hard. I just can't forgive this person. They've hurt me so deeply. But if you recognize how much you have been forgiven, then you say, there's absolutely no grounds for me to refuse to forgive somebody else, seeing what God has forgiven me. And I want to tell you, forgiveness can make a new person out of some people. When they've been eaten up with anger and bitterness and resentment and wrath over a long period of time, and to clean that out by confessing it to the Lord, making it right with the person where that difference has existed, what a change that can be. You can start out the year with a lighter heart and a more positive outlook about every aspect of life. And that's something that's not just dealt with once or twice. It's over and over again in the Word of God. It's practical, it's real, it's down to where we live every day. I find some people, when you begin to talk about these things that concern how we live, how we can have a better marriage, how we can have better Christian homes, how we can have stronger churches, how we can have greater spiritual strength and blessing in our life, some people get very excited about it in the beginning. And then when they find out that some of this change is going to be a bit painful, it's going to be hard on the flesh, they kind of lose their interest and say, well, you know, I'd like to see that, but I'm just not up to the task. I just, what it really comes down to, basically, we're not going to change in any area of our life until the pain of continuing like we are becomes so great that we're willing to go through the ordeal to change and do that which God has bidden us to do. As long as we're just living with the situation, saying it's too difficult for me, it's too unpleasant to me to have to go through this change. But you see, the Lord is continually, through His precious Word, through this gospel message, calling upon us to make a change. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that alien sinners can change themselves. I'm talking to a people that I believe have been changed by divine grace. That's the miraculous change that must occur when Jesus Christ takes up His abode in the human heart. When that one who is dead in trespasses and in sin is born again, he's a new creation. There's the great change where it all starts. But when one has been born of the Spirit, now there is to be continual growth, and therefore growth means change, and it means positive change, and it means crucifying the old nature
going to the cross on a daily basis, dying out to self and selfishness, and to change in our outlook, in our attitude, in godliness, in the way that we endeavor to serve the Lord, and in turn endeavor to serve one another. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. They shall perish. Everything to which we become attached here in this present world, it's temporary, it's passing. Think about the past year from this standpoint. While you can see a lot of your time spent in idle interest, what things do you treasure most about the year that has passed? What things do you really still hold on to that are meaningful to you? Are they not those things in which the Lord was the center and focus of whatever was involved? Yes, the young couple that was married this year can say, what a wonderful, happy experience that was. But even in that marriage, if it is a good marriage, it's such because you asked the direction of God's Holy Spirit in that decision and asked His blessing upon your marriage. If you found a job that gives you a lot of satisfaction, you give thanks to God for blessing you to have it, and ask for grace that you may not become married to the job, but seek first still the kingdom of God. You think about time you wasted in some areas that is just gone. You say, how foolish I was to have spent time in such idle things. But think about those moments that you were with the Lord in prayer, in the reading of His Word, in the service of God where the gospel was preached. In those moments when you said, oh, I'm so glad to be here. I'd rather be here in this old Baptist meeting than any place on earth. How good the Lord is. Those are memories that nobody can take away from you. Those are treasures. They're not going to be burned up. You can keep those. And may these thoughts focus our attention for the year that is to come, to realize that so much of what we become anxious about, upset about, concerned about, it really doesn't matter, because a lot of it's already under the sentence of ultimate change. It's going to be burned up. But may we keep our heart, our mind, our attention focused upon Jesus Christ, the one who never changes. I close by sharing with you this little experience. Some of you may have heard me mention it briefly on the radio a few weeks ago. The first of this month, I was in a meeting in Tampa, Florida. And brethren asked if I would want to go over to St. Joseph Hospital with them on that Saturday afternoon, because there was a brother who was dying of cancer that had requested to be baptized. He had attended an old Baptist meeting for many years. He used to live up in the state of Kentucky. Gone to service there, but time after time had put off what he knew to be his duty. After he moved to Florida, he attended the services on a fairly consistent basis, but time after time resisted doing what he knew he ought to do. Came down with cancer. Cancer had eaten through his spinal column, and he was paralyzed from his waist down.